Decatur County Commissioners. The NSTB.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Pete French. I'm here on behalf of the appellants who are three governmental entities, four shippers, and an interested party. This case is about a decision by the Surface Transportation Board finding that a railroad can ignore known needed repairs to a rail line, reduce maintenance costs tenfold, then stop service, then triple rates, then get sued.
Not stop service for a period of time.
For 46 days.
Well, it's a period of time, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. Right. Then issue an embargo that lasts 20 months for the purpose of weighing options either to sell the line or abandon. That is not the law in this circuit or in any federal court in this country. In fact, if the Surface Transportation Board's decision is upheld, it will be a reversal of longstanding law, and it will render federal statutes 11101 and 10903 meaningless. Years ago in Gibbons versus United States, Judge Cudahy addressed the issue of when an embargo may be imposed. And in that case, involving the Rock Island Railroad, the petitioners claimed that in a position of cashlessness, certainly the common carrier duty terminates. And the court said no. The embargo is a temporary emergency measure that allows discontinuing service where performance is impossible. The railroad in this case never said it's impossible for us to perform. And indeed, Your Honors, the railroad here had $1.1 million in cash on hand, nearly three times the amount necessary to make repairs and restore service. What the railroad argued here was it'll be unprofitable for us and imprudent from a business perspective for us to make these repairs because we lose money on this line.
Of course, you're dealing here with a short line railroad that doesn't have much capital or much trackage, for that matter. And in applying these rules, don't you think that you've got to apply them in the context of what you're dealing with here? You're not dealing with a major railroad that presumably has some capital resources. You're dealing with just a fragment of a railroad here.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, however, the railroad had $1.1 million in cash on hand to make the necessary...
Wasn't that money, though, owed elsewhere?
No, Your Honor. There was money owed to pay off debt.
Right.
And in the Gibbons case, what the court said is, in the circumstances where a railroad imposes an embargo, the people who lose are the shareholders and the creditors. And that happens until the point where abandonment occurs. And if I may quote the case, the court said, viewed as a matter of economics, abandonment represents the final stage in the carrier's passage from operation to liquidation. Before abandonment, the bankrupt railroad is burdened with a public service obligation, which can be fulfilled only at a loss to the creditors and shareholders. Some losses continue at least until the certificate of abandonment issues and the service obligation terminates. No abandonment certificate was ever issued in this case, and the errors made by the board are pure errors of law. In this case, the board considered not whether the railroad had the financial ability to repair and restore service, but the cost to rehabilitate the line and restore service. It considered not whether the railroad had the financial wherewithal, but whether it would be profitable over the long term. And finally, in examining profitability, the board improperly limited the financial wherewithal of the railroad to income from operations. In this case, this railroad had substantial income from real estate sales, and that income made it more than possible, whether profitable or not, for the railroad to make repairs. The court...
The railroad here apparently made efforts to see that the shippers could be served by other means than by this embargoed track. Do you think that goes anywhere toward discharging their common carrier obligation?
Not in this case, Your Honor, where the embargo was imposed only after the complaint was filed, and where, during the course of the case, those railroads never actually came forward and said, we'll provide service under these conditions. This is a case in which, unlike in Gibbons or in the GS Roofing case, the railroad, when it found out about the repairs, did nothing. It didn't even contact the shippers to see if the shippers would contribute to the contribute funds to repair and restore service. In this case,
is that usually the procedure?
That, in my mind, Your Honor,
well, I'm asking your mind. Is there any case law that says that they're obligated to do it?
In the GS Roofing case, Your Honor, the shippers did.
I said, is there any case law that mandates that they do that?
It is not a requirement. It's merely sound business judgment, Your Honor.
In your opinion?
In my opinion.
That they should do it in this case or in all? Aren't all of these cases just fact-specific?
This case is not, the errors that we're complaining about in this case are not fact-specific. And the chronology of events in this case are undisputed. On February 1 of 1996, the railroad received an opinion from an expert that it hired that said the trackage conditions at milepost 32 should be your number one priority. 6 months later, the board's vice president, John Johnson, said it'll cost us $42,000 to make these repairs. It can be done in a matter of weeks. For 6 months, the railroad did nothing. In 1996, it had $800,000 in net profit and $3.5 million in net income, yet it did
nothing. How much did they have to pay off on their loans at the same time?
Your Honor, railroads are public carriers. They're charged with the duty of public trust.
I didn't ask you that. I asked you how much did they have to pay off on their loans.
At this time, Your Honor, I cannot tell the court.
Well,
exactly.
Wouldn't that be taken into consideration?
It should not
in
be.
In the financial position of that railroad?
In the position, Your Honor, where the railroad has the cash to make the repairs, it must make the repairs. The issue is not one.
Irrespective of any loans or debt.
Yes, Your Honor, because the issue is one of impossibility of performance, not business prudence. I see I'm running into my rebuttal time.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Alice Saylor. I'm here this morning representing the Surface Transportation Board and the United States. The test for the reasonableness of a rail embargo is indeed a test of reasonableness, and it is fact-specific and therefore must be made on a case-by-case basis, as the board did here. There are five relevant considerations which have been discussed at length in the briefs. There's no disagreement, I don't believe, between the board and the complainants in this case about what those five considerations are. The one fact, the one consideration.
One of them is intent, I believe.
Correct.
How does that apply here? What considerations are involved in a determination of intent?
The specific test could be phrased whether the railroad did not intend to ever restore service, or at least that's the way the test has been phrased. And the board specifically addressed that and found that despite a 20-month period of time, which is longer than the average embargo, that the railroad was exploring its options and the board found did intend to do something to restore service.
Is that a determination of good faith, in effect? Is that what we're talking about?
That would be one way to describe it, yes. But the railroad here was not doing nothing, was not just sitting there. There are some old embargo cases that the court found the railroad was simply doing nothing for an extended period of time. That was not the case here.
Well, can't we infer that their failure to fix the railroad when the costs were cheap and the cash was on hand was an indication that they really wanted to abandon it?
I believe that that is an exercise in hindsight. The railroad probably had many other points on its track, which was deteriorating on the entire 81-mile length of this line, where they could have put money that might have prevented something in the future. And the fact that this track washed out at a particular milepost in the spring of 97 is something we know now, but they did not know in 96 at which exact point was going to be the most critical.
But even as they were weighing options, don't you think 20 months is a long time to weigh those options?
It is longer than the average embargo, but the balancing factor, which the board placed great weight on, was the fact that these shippers did not lose access to rail service. That makes this case unique. In fact, I have found no other embargo decision, either in a court or from the board or its predecessor, the Interstate Commerce Commission.
Couldn't
where
the railroad take action to see that they had coverage for half that period of time, 20 months?
Pardon me, I didn't hear.
Didn't the railroad take action to see that they did have coverage to ship over another railroad or railroads for some for half of that period of time, 20 months?
Very promptly, they put in place a rerouting option that would have served every single shipper. There were no shippers on the 16 miles that were out of service. They were all either on one side or the other.
And for how long a period of time did they make that available?
That was made available, I believe, within a few weeks.
I said for how long?
For the entire remainder until the track was repaired in November of 98.
And did you find any cases that had a comparable period of delay, that is 20 months?
There were several old cases. When I say old cases, I'm referring to cases from the 1970s or earlier. We had a significant change in the statute in 1980. There was a case, the Baltimore and Annapolis case, which is referred to, that extended longer than that. There was a case, in fact, I believe Overbrook Farmers Union, which was an 89 ICC case, was 3 years. There have been longer embargoes. Both of those, however, were found to be unreasonable. Both of those cut off all the shippers who were at the sub end of a line and had no access during the embargo to rail service.
And how much weight should we give to the fact that this rerouting was so costly to the shippers?
The rerouting was at an enhanced price. There was a surcharge announced, and it was clear that it was connected to the rerouting. The railroad had to go in a different direction, operate over a longer route, and work with other carriers to do it, so it passed through those costs. That is indeed what they're supposed to do. There was, at the board level, a challenge of the rate that has been abandoned. There is not, in my view, a rate reasonableness challenge possible here because there is alternate truck service available, so there is no market dominance, which is a prerequisite of a rate challenge.
One of the objections here is that the board took into consideration the cost of repairing the whole line rather than just this segment that was embargoed in weighing the options here. What's your response to that? Of course, it occurred to me that possibly the repaired the segment that was embargoed and the rest of the line wasn't up to snuff. It wouldn't do you much good to repair the segment, but that may not be the right answer. What is the right
two
answer?
Points very quickly. First of all, just looking at the embargo segment, the cost to restore that to its pre-embargo condition, not a better condition, the same condition it had been, was more than $750,000. This was a significant amount of money for a small, somewhat struggling railroad. Second of all, and I've reviewed the record and the board's decision, they looked at a lot of numbers. They looked at all the numbers the parties brought them on the record. One of those numbers was the $556,000 to put the whole line into a condition that would be efficient for good service for the future. That was not the number the board used, and I believe it's clear in the board's decision. $369,230, which is a number I don't believe that the petitioners dispute, was the repair cost for the embargo segment. That was the critical number.
And what about counsel's number when he talked about the cash that was on hand that the railroad had to make those repairs?
the indebtedness and the other obligations have to be balanced against that, first of all, and second of all, in so much as the cash on hand came from either a fortuitous sale of real estate not needed for rail operations or from cash infusions from the corporate parent, which happened regularly during the 9-year history of this railroad to keep its nose above water. Those should not be taken to be cash available to deal with rail operations. So concluding, this is a reasonableness test. The board carefully balanced the appropriate factors, and I believe the decision should be upheld. Thank you very
Council.
Much.
2.5 minutes, Council M.
Your Honor, it's a reasonable test in terms of, is it impossible for this rail line to restore safe service because of a physical condition on the line or because financially the railroad just can't do it? In this case, there is no evidence that there was a physical condition that could not be repaired to restore service. That's not the issue. It's only whether the railroad had the financial wherewithal to do so. We didn't hear today that the railroad did not have the financial wherewithal to do so. Its failure to restore service for 20 months is patently unreasonable. Council talked about intent and 20 months being longer than average. 20 months is not only longer than average, Your Honor, it's longer than permitted by the American Association of Railroads regulation governing embargoes by 8 months. As to intent, also there was some argument concerning.
Let me ask you, do you refer to that regulation in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's also referred to in the opinion of the Surface Transportation Board in a footnote. I believe it's footnote 4, but I'm subject to check. I'd be happy to find it.
Well, now that you've said it, I'll just make a note of it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's okay.
It's on the first page of the decision, footnote 3. An embargo is issued by a railroad through notice to the AAR and may remain in effect for 1 year unless the railroad cancels or amends it. That never happened in this case.
What never happened?
There was no cancellation of the notice and no amendment of the notice. It simply remained in place for 20 months. 8 months too long, even under the maximum range of what an embargo can last under the regulation. Examining intent, Council also discussed whether the railroad may attempt to abandon as an exercise in hindsight. Indeed, it is not an exercise in hindsight. In this case, the railroad did petition for an exemption to abandon this rail line. That petition was denied by the Surface Transportation Board, which then was met by the railroad with a petition to reopen, which was later withdrawn in November of 1998 when the railroad was purchased. The use of the petition to exemption and the embargo procedure to weigh options to see if someone would purchase or sell is not a proper use of the embargo procedure, and it's a misuse of the abandonment procedure. And the abandonment procedure is designed so that, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time.
I'll give you 30 seconds, please.
Thank you. So that the Surface Transportation Board may specifically determine what the harm to the public will be before terminating the common carrier service obligation. That determination was never made in this case, and the embargo procedure is not the forum or the mechanism for making that determination.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Council. We will proceed.